I think when we're talking about metabolic syndrome, we're really talking about insulin resistance. At the end of the day, it is in fact syndrome X. It is in fact insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is the root of all evil. And this, I'm oversimplifying clearly, but it's something at the root of all evil. If you're insulin resistant and your sugar is not entering into your muscle cells, well, guess what else needs sugar? The glucose. So your brain runs almost exclusively off of glucose. So if you're insulin resistant, you're not going to think as well. And guess what loves insulin? Cancer cells.
Welcome to the Precision Medicine Made Simple podcast, where we simplify the complex world of precision medicine. We're here to explore how personalized healthcare can empower you to understand and improve your health to live a longer and healthier life. Join us as we break down the latest in medical science into actionable insights. Let's make precision medicine accessible and actionable for everyone. Enjoy the show. Today's episode is sponsored by Biography Health, where healthcare meets personalization. With their D-enabled blueprint, Biography Health empowers you with a health plan based on your unique DNA, aiming to prevent disease and extend your life. Take control of your health journey with a plan as unique as you. Visit biographyhealth.com and start your personalized healthcare journey today. As a reminder, this episode is for educational purposes only. This episode is in no way a replacement for professional health advice. Please consult with your professional primary care provider for medical advice. If at any point you feel that a topic discussed on our podcast was misrepresented, or if you have additional insights that could enhance our discussions, we wholeheartedly encourage you to reach out to us. Your feedback is invaluable in helping us improve and in ensuring our content remains both informative and reflective of the latest developments in precision medicine. For this episode, Dr. Stanford, Alyssa Stanford, and Taylor Koo dive into the complexities of metabolic syndrome, how it can relate to several chronic diseases, and discuss the impact of genetics, diet, and exercise on our overall health. We also touch on the importance of precision medicine and continuous glucose monitoring in managing conditions like diabetes, and touch on some of the benefits of medications currently out there like Ozempic.
Do you mind just giving a quick definition of what metabolic syndrome is?
Yeah, I'm very unclear about what it actually entails.
Well, you know, that historically, and I can't remember the gentleman's name that identified this, initially identified it, and when it was taught to me, it was initially called Syndrome X.
Syndrome X.
Now, what X was insulin resistance. So there, and when we talk in medicine about a syndrome, it's a collection of signs or symptoms that seem to go together, that there's an apparent thread that ties. So in the example of Syndrome X, insulin resistance, there were a subset. Well, they were able to identify that it seemed to run in conjunction with high blood pressure, dyslipidemia in the form of high triglycerides and low HDL. And I guess I already said hypertension and obesity. So the obesity, they're mainly talking about waist circumference these days. And with the fasting glucose levels, they think more in terms of, yeah, fasting glucose levels, but also fasting insulin levels and insulin resistance. And they have further noticed that this constellation of signs and symptoms would go together with other chronic disease processes, such as diabetes, obesity, of course, cancer risk, and risk of neurodegenerative diseases, et cetera. So it's really a very core feature of health. And the reason it's important for us to think of in terms of precision medicine is that there's genetic predispositions to metabolic syndrome, mainly because there's genetic predispositions to all those elements that we just described. There's genetic risk associated with body mass index and waist circumference. There's genetic risk associated with dyslipidemia, the low HDL, the high triglycerides, definitely polygenic risk associated with hypertension and the rest. So if you can identify with genetics those parts of the metabolic syndrome that you might be at risk for, then that gives you a target for treatment and intervention to certainly delay or prevent the onset of metabolic syndrome if possible, or if you're addressing it, it would suggest targets of treatment.
Now, within each of those indicators, then, like, if you just have one of them, would you then consider that you have metabolic syndrome and then have trouble with insulin resistance, or do you need like a combination of them?
So to meet criteria, you have to have three of those five.
Okay.
You know, certainly it's on a continuum where I would say that for all of us, we would like none of those to be out of whack, and that would be the goal. But they do exist as independent risk factors, but together, it's also meaningful to meet that criteria of metabolic syndrome. I should say it's meaningful to try to not meet that criteria of metabolic syndrome to ensure you have the best shot at not getting cancer, not getting neurodegenerative disease, not getting heart disease.
Oh, so what you're saying is that if you were to tell your patient you have metabolic syndrome, and I would say as the patient, well, what does that mean to me? Is that what am I at risk for? How is that going to hurt me? And of course, then I'd ask, what should I do about it?
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack. But I would start by saying, well, in the context of personalized precision medicine, we're assessing overall risk of a variety of chronic diseases. So, yeah, we talk about this every week. Those chronic diseases fall in the large categories of cardiovascular, neurovascular disease, peripheral vascular disease. We lump all those together somewhat. Neurodegenerative disease, which is a spectrum of diseases also, most notably Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, and the like. There's a variety of types of dementia that are on that neurodegenerative disease spectrum. And we know that there's commonality and all these chronic diseases. So for example, inflammation, oxidative stress, and I didn't mention cancer, but cancer is also something that will be aggravated and, quote, helped or promoted by metabolic syndrome. So for purposes of overall health, you're going to want to address those addressable things across the board to decrease your risk of those chronic diseases later in life. The good news is there's a lot of runway. These diseases, metabolic syndrome starts in childhood, and the effects of it, though, over the course of decades, can lead to those things we just mentioned. So heart disease, cancer, neurodegenerative, diabetes, autoimmune, all those things that you're at higher risk for in the face of oxidative stress and a deranged glucose insulin metabolism.
I remember sitting at a dinner with a young group of people actually in their 20s, and one of the gentlemen said he was just diagnosed with fatty liver.
Yeah.
Is that at all involved or a part of the metabolic syndrome?
It is. So with insulin resistance,
He was 20.
Yeah. So, it can be, and you don't have to be obese to have fatty liver.
No, he was a little overweight too, but he happened to be overweight.
But, normally, physiologically, you would want the fat you would like to have is in your subcutaneous tissue area, and you would want insulin to be, you want to be active enough, and that insulin's driving blood glucose into your muscle cells. And if it's not needed there, and if it goes into the fat pathway, maybe the subcutaneous tissues, what has been shown to be pretty harmful globally and from a long-term health perspective is what we call visceral fat. And so liver is one of the viscera that fat can accumulate in. And that can be really dangerous. Heard recently that whereas liver transplantation, the number one reason to get liver transplantation in my medical career was hepatitis C and alcoholism were the main pathways to cirrhosis. Now they're predicting that fatty liver disease will take over as the number one reason that people ultimately need a liver transplant.
And that's
really
genetic or diet?
No, that's modern living. You know, so the story is that it's an ancient story. So with prehistoric man, before we settled down into villages and the agrarian farming lifestyle, grain-based diet, et cetera, it was probably a selective advantage to be able to carry around some fat with you and be able to store, you know, fat for later use. And of course, people were moving around a lot in that era because you would move from place to place. You know, they say tribes of people would move from place to place daily or weekly. They had anything but a sedentary lifestyle. That all changed about 8,000 or 9,000 years ago when we started to settle down into villages and towns, and then probably for a few thousand years after that, the vast majority of people did subsistence farming. So they would, most people were farmers, like 80 or 90% of the people, what they did was farm. So fast forward to these last few hundred years, and especially the last 100 years, where the food industry has progressed, and we've progressed as a civilization to where we have easy access to refined sugar and a lot of access to, you know, a carbohydrate grain-based diet. And at the root of it, this is really a problem of our modern society, that we now have free access to all that. And so it's a new problem for our bodies to deal with, something we haven't evolved right alongside with. The evolution does not occur on the scale of 100 years. It occurs on the scale of tens of thousands of years. And so here we are. The food industry, I think, has done an amazing job of solving the problem. And we as a global society have done an amazing job of solving world starvation. It used to be that even when I was a kid, you would hear about famines that were true famines, that there just wasn't enough food to go around. And now fast forward 50 years later, there's plenty of food to go around. It's no longer a problem where there's a true famine. All the famines we have now are political famines. And
fast food.
And so, yeah, so you have to, you have to give it to the food industry and the agricultural industry. They've solved the tremendous problem with increased efficiencies, et cetera. But they've created inadvertently, I'm sure, a whole new
set
of health risks.
Well, and from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but not only is it about just the type of refined sugar and processed foods that people are intaking, but there's also a pretty heavy emphasis on how the body interprets and internalizes that food then, correct? Because, I mean, based on some previous conversations that we were having, it's really just how each of our bodies breaks down food completely differently than anybody else's. I guess there could be some patterns based on.
We are all unique, but there are some shared tendencies. Yeah.
shared tendencies, right? Because like my family, I think we have some, I think I have some aunts and uncles that are diabetic or even pre-diabetic. Mm-hmm. And so I would assume then that I, well, am at an increased risk of having, let's say, metabolic syndrome.
Yeah. So there's definitely an inherited component to it. You can, you know, look around at families you see walking together. You go, yeah, they all seem to have the same body habitus and et cetera. And, you know, some of that is going to be environmental, that they, you know, eat similar things, have similar lifestyle habits. But there's definitely a huge heritable component to it. And what's interesting about that is going forward in the future of healthcare, which is precision medicine, we're going to be doing, we're able to look at specific genetic variation to predict what the problems likely are and what the most effective interventions would likely to be. You know, on top of those very obvious interventions to, you know, get plenty of exercise, get your sleep, avoid processed foods and this metabolic and this global metabolic situation, diets that would be that would aggravate oxidative stress, for example, and inflammation.
I think it's really interesting how we're in a time where people are very health conscious and know not a lot because we have access to the information, young and older. But then we're also living in a time where, at least in California, in certain states, like marijuana is legal. And I love to share what I hear on the radio. I heard that there is a certain group of the demographic, like 18 to 25, and don't hold me to that, but generally about that age that are, you know, doing, enjoying the weed, and there's a uptick in some munchies and an uptick in fast food ordering, and specifically Little Caesars. I don't know why they mentioned that on the radio, but that's one.
I was wondering why Little Caesars opens at 4:20 in the afternoon. So now I.
But it's a real thing, and you're thinking, wow, that's such a, you know.
Well, and it's so accessible too. I mean, they're offering their $5 pizzas now, and I mean, they've always had the $5 pizzas. I mean, it's just really cheap and affordable.
It's going to accelerate that fatty liver thing, though. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. So that, you know, so there's clearly also a socioeconomic, element to this. You know, now the less economically advantaged people tend to eat the meat and whatnot, whereas and the well-to-do can afford the chia seeds and sesame seed kale salads or whatever, whereas you know, historically it was the opposite, of course. So, well, and what's driving and of course again the food industry, and you know, I'll leave it to others to come down hard on them. You know, if you have fast, cheap, tastes great, easy to get your hands on food, that's what the vast majority of us are going to go for in trying to get through your day-to-day life in a place like Los Angeles. And if you've had a little marijuana earlier in the day, certainly Caesars and Taco Bell are going to come right to the top of the list.
But this is all like choices. I mean, it really sounds like it all comes down to lifestyle and choices, but there's an element of, as you were saying earlier, the genetics too, right? Where I remember hearing that everybody has a different makeup for how much fat you can hold.
So, I mean, that's a good point. So if you want to think of your subcutaneous fat as being kind of a reservoir, and everybody doesn't carry their fat in the same place in the same way. And there is definitely a big genetic component to that. So, again, the obesity that's carried us, what we call central obesity, so obesity carried around the waist, that really reflects not subcutaneous fat so much as the visceral fat, so that winds up ultimately being the risk factor. But one of the ways to think about the subcutaneous fat is it's a, you need some fat, you need some place to, for, blood sugar to go to be stored. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you want to limit your caloric intake so that there's not, so those reservoirs don't get filled up, so to speak, and overflow into the visceral fat. But we're going to have different genetic abilities to do that. But the counter to it is just to simply eat less.
And exercise.
Yeah, because you want. Because movement, movement in general, that's why, we're hearing a lot of it. It makes perfect sense that people that, even if you exercise, if you spend the rest of your 12 hours a day sitting in one spot, that portends poorly for you, because that means there's that much more part of your day where blood sugar isn't getting driven into the muscle cells for use, but it's getting driven into the subcutaneous and visceral fat stores.
I did not realize that happens when I'm just sitting down at a desk, and because I always knew that standing up, I guess, is good, and sitting down, your just body's not moving, and I can imagine things are sort of stagnant. But I didn't realize that there was an impact to my blood sugar as well.
Yeah, definitely. So if you ever want to, a lot of us use continuous glucose monitors just to see how our blood sugars react to things we eat and movement, et cetera. You can do a little experiment. So, your mom says don't eat standing up, or your wife tries to get you not to eat standing up. Well, it turns out that probably eating standing up is a lot healthier than eating sitting down. If you can do a little experiment about how your blood sugars react to a meal, to a carbohydrate load, by the difference between walking around or standing while you eat as opposed to sitting. Part of the reason why it's such a good idea to, after dinner, to get up and go take the dog for a walk.
And so, well, we've been talking a lot about just things that we can externally see. I mean, there's indicators that somewhat seem obvious, but there's an easy assumption that, like, okay, this person might have, let's say, metabolic syndrome. What are now some of those other indicators that aren't?
But key is that you can't tell from looking at someone just because, just because they have, a high percentage of body fat, et cetera, it all depends. You can not have metabolic syndrome. And certainly there are people that have a relatively thin body habitus that do have metabolic. But anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
I think that's the really interesting part is how some people who are thin.
I have lots of thin diabetic patients.
Have a low capacity to store fat.
Yeah.
And so they are not necessarily as thin, it's, they think. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I appreciate the breakdown. And that's where I was really leading to is like, I guess not every overweight person is going to have metabolic syndrome, but yeah. What are those then? Like, how does that work if somebody is skinny and then also diabetic? Then?
It can work itself out that they're hypertensive and maybe they've inherited a poor lipid profile, and maybe they're thin, but they eat a lot of foods that, like ice cream and steaks, that will cause your triglycerides to go high. So they're going to meet criteria just based on that.
And they don't exercise.
But one other thing, and I'm not an endocrinologist or a diabetologist, but I have listened enough to know that what is becoming clear is there's more than one kind of type 2 diabetes. So the smart people I listen to in lecture and lectures say there's at least four kinds. And I would say that based on looking at my patients' continuous glucose monitors and people that are pre-diabetic despite being on the thin side, it's clear that people have a different picture. I think when we're talking about metabolic syndrome, we're really talking about insulin resistance. At the end of the day, it is in fact syndrome X. It is in fact insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is the root of all evil. And this I'm oversimplifying clearly, but it's something at the root of all evil. If you're insulin resistant and you're sugar is not entering into your muscle cells, well, guess what else needs sugar? The glucose. So your brain runs almost exclusively off of glucose. So if you're insulin resistant, you're not going to think as well. And guess what loves insulin? Cancer cells. So if you're insulin, one of the connections and the others, oxidative stress and inflammation, which is also a milieu that cancer loves. So, I digress there, but it's insulin resistance at the end of the day.
In insulin resistance, and excuse me for just backing up really quick, is just the, actually, I don't even know how to articulate it. Can you break down what insulin resistance really means?
So good question. And it's just going to be two parts of the answer. So, and we'll wind up in diabetes at the end. So as you have higher and higher blood sugar, let's just say that you eat a lot of foods with fructose, corn syrup, and you hit the Persian bakery pretty frequently, you're going to tend to have high blood sugars, more often than the person that eats nothing but cardboard, right? Mediterranean diet, I call it the cardboard diet, but it's actually really good for you. So if you do it, do it. If you're not doing it, do it. But you're going to have high levels of glucose, and that's going to provoke your pancreas to secrete insulin. So insulin, though, has a way of, and we have this term in medicine called homeostasis, which means everything tries to bring itself back to some kind of equilibrium. And if there's a lot of insulin around, then the receptors and the cells that would normally take the glucose, they're going to downregulate. And so it's going to take that much more insulin to get the glucose into the cells. And so I was in Peter Attia's book, he uses the analogy, it's like blowing into a balloon. So the insulin is trying to drive the sugar into the cells. And the more insulin the cells see, the less receptive they're going to be to insulin because they're trying to maintain this homeostasis.
So they just kind of...
So it pushes, walls it off, kind of pushes back. And your body's response to that, what's your body's response? Oh, there's still a lot of blood sugar around here. Better get put some more insulin out. So you wind up with these, hyperinsulinemia is the medical term. So high levels of insulin in your blood. And all the cells of the body then start becoming inured to these high levels of insulin. Eventually, your pancreas tires out, burns out, won't produce that much insulin. That's when you become diabetic and when a type 2 diabetic starts requiring insulin.
Wow. So while that's happening, then you've also got the fat overflowing into your organs and you've got the pancreas.
Yeah, so if you can't drive the glucose into the muscle cells and brain cells where it's needed, it's going to go into the fat cells. And then when you've saturated the subcutaneous fat, so to speak, there's no more room for the fat cells to expand, then it is going to deposit in the viscera, the internal organs of your abdomen.
And then it taxes your pancreas all the while.
Yeah, so it is a,
wow,
you know, positive feedback loop. It's, you know, you're in the coffin spiral of diabetes at that point.
Can you exercise or diet off of a genetic predisposition to any of these things?
Yeah, absolutely. So
I mean,
we all know, I was just on a call with a guy of Filipino descent whose both his parents are diabetic. So his response to that was, so for 20 years, he's been running marathons and eating healthy, and he shows no signs of even being pre-diabetic. Long-winded way of saying, you know, this is a disease of modern society, and it can be defeated by, for the most part, an oversimplification, but with diet and exercise, certainly.
So what are the numbers, like, what do you look at when you're getting your blood test back? What am I looking at that says, oh, wow, I need a glucose monitor?
Well, first of all, everyone would probably benefit from having a glucose monitor a little bit, just for a couple of weeks, maybe 4 weeks, just to see how their body reacts to different things they eat and movement. That's and what their blood sugars are doing at night. It's very informative. To answer your question directly, the three things I look at, and again, I wouldn't consider myself an expert in this field per se, but just to get an idea, is I look at the fasting glucose levels. So people that are insulin resistant will tend to have very high fasting insulin levels. They'll tend to have high fasting glucose levels. So the criteria for prediabetes is anything over 100 with fasting glucose levels. Then, of course, we look at the hemoglobin A1C, which is a reflection. That's the amount of sugar that gets deposited on red blood, on the hemoglobin, the protein of red blood cells. They call that glycation. And so, you know, sometimes you'll see it, that glycated hemoglobin or hemoglobin A1C is a measure of how much sugar is on there. The reason why it's an average is because your blood red blood cells turn over about every 120 days or so. So you can get an idea of the average glucose that the person has had for the past several months based on that hemoglobin A1C. What's wrong with that, though? Well, what's wrong with the hemoglobin A1C and why you need a continuous glucose monitor? Because it's an average. If I told you that it took an hour to go 60 miles, that could be because you went to 60 miles in 1 minute, you're doing 360 miles an hour. Or it could be that you, average 60 miles an hour the whole time. So it doesn't really tell you about the trip in between. It just tells you on average. And so not very helpful, not very sophisticated. You know, so a much better way, and again, this is leveraging the science of, say, by the way, I believe you can buy continuous glucose monitors at the drugstore now. You don't need a prescription. Are you sure about that? And
so wearables meaning like my watch wouldn't have any kind of glucose measurement, just something that I'd have to.
Yeah.
And then you can connect it to an app of some sort. Is that?
Yeah. So there's an app on your phone. You basically stick the thing on your Freestyle Libre by Abbott, not a commercial printer, but it's the one my patients that they use.
Okay.
It has an app on your iPhone. Your iPhone, just bringing your iPhone in proximity to it, will, the continuous glucose monitor on your arm will sync to it and download. Oh, I think it's about 7 hours of data. You'll get a continuous trace of your blood sugars over the last 7 hours. Now, it's not perfect because you're in the interstitial space. You're not in the blood vessel. So it's not exactly the same as a blood glucose reading. So a lot of times you'll see people that will you know, stick their finger and do the finger stick way of measuring blood sugar, and it'll be, it won't be the same number as coming from their arm. So it's not at all a perfect kind of thing, but once you get the hang of it and you can see what causes it generally to go up and down, it's a good surrogate for blood glucose.
Is that a short-term measurement? It's not like an ongoing...
They will have finger stick?
No, the glucose, that's not how, let's say if I were diabetic, that's not what I would wear.
No, they do.
Forever and ever?
Some do.
Oh, really?
So there's another brand out there that the diabetics seem to use more. I think it's called Dexcom, something like that. And it goes on the abdomen. And so, for example, you will know diabetics that are usually type 1 diabetics, that's where the autoimmune, you have an autoimmune reaction to your pancreas and wipe out the beta islet cells that produce the insulin and the pancreas. Those people produce no insulin, so they will have an insulin pump implanted, and they'll have it tied to something like a Dexcom, or Nisa, I don't remember.
Right, yeah. That's why.
So diabetics do, and in fact, that was the original indication for them. Biohackers getting the idea that it would be fun to self-quantify your blood glucose and have the usefulness of it, that kind of came along after the fact. But I love that. I love using them. I love that when my patients use them, especially the ones that are healthy, because you can get to a lot of issues that you may not know about, the other thing I didn't get to, when you spike these high insulin levels, when you become insulin resistant, you'll get this secondary phenomenon called reactive hypoglycemia, because now you've got all this insulin up at a high level hanging around. Eventually it does kick in, and when it does, your blood sugars, bottom out, so to speak, and that's when you have that fatigue in the afternoon.
So I'm curious with how we are currently treating this then, and then how precision medicine is then going to improve and prevent this, because like right now it sounds like, well, how often are people, do people do these at physicals where they get their blood sugar or their glucose levels and hemoglobin and the A1C, is that a common thing, or
the glucose levels and A1C are very common. Checking someone's fasting insulin level, I'm just starting to see that. I was actually pretty excited to see a UCLA doctor the other day check it on one of my patients.
But you do it for your patients.
But I mean, someone taught me to do that a few years ago. This isn't taught to you in medical school. It might be now, I doubt it. But
it's picking up though. Like
it's picking up. And it's another thing that plagues our current healthcare delivery model, in that from the time someone comes up with an idea or finds something in the lab to where it finds its way into guidelines, or, society-driven guidelines or population-based recommendations, can be a decade or more. So
now, and knowing full well that it's right there, the technology is there, it's right there, and it's very helpful tool. It just, I don't understand that. I don't understand how we would use those, everything we have.
Right. Well, and so with where we're at now then, and I see these commercials all the time, and I'd be curious knowing the difference. Well, I mean, obviously they're going to be very different, but I see Ozempic commercials all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, being a medicine to help, I don't fully know what it actually does. I know it's somewhat related to diabetes. I don't really know how it, like,
well, it's indication symptoms. It's indication for diabetes, and it's what's called a glucagon like peptide. That's the GLP-1 receptor agonist for the type 1 receptor. That's the long fancy name for it. Exactly how, you know, why, yeah, I do know the basics of it is that when there's binding to this particular receptor, it signals a few different things, you know, in the gut, but, and many people listening to this will appreciate that there's a gut-brain axis. There's a lot of communication between the gut and the brain. And well, one of the ways this works is by satisfying the satiety, you know, the satiation, you know, signal. So one of the things that is in play with the insulin resistance is you're not getting the blood sugar into the cells, and your body is telling you, I'm still hungry. You know, so if you can interrupt that with this class of medications, it has an amazing effect. It also apparently has other effects on brain functions and psychological and psychiatric stuff. So there's a lot of people using, they find that people that use Ozempic tend to drink less alcohol. So it seems to help people that have alcoholic tendencies. It's used off label for bulimics to get them to stop obsessing about food. They've had, you know, great success with that. So it really, you're going to start seeing, you'll start seeing some information that is coming out that these medications have a variety of benefits. And I'm sure ultimately it will come out that there will be some downside to them. The current downside is it slows down your GI tract and it can lead to constipation. And I know there's been at least anecdotal cases where people have had severe intractable constipation caused by this class of drugs. But overall, I think, you know, and so you gave your little, we gave our little preface on this, that this is not medical advice. And I'm not a diabetologist or an expert on obesity medications, et cetera. But I think, I think we're just going to see wider use of these drugs, although you do see a lot of interesting statistics that people, I want to say that 2/3 of people that start this class of drugs aren't on them after a year, or maybe it's 1/3, but it's a very large number of people that go off of these medications for whatever reason. Now, it's important to note that with these medications, where I've seen the most success, and I do write it for my patients, you know, if they meet indications, and certainly for weight loss, and certainly for people with prediabetes that look like they're kind of really going the wrong way, it can be a somewhat miraculous drug. Now, if you stop it, you'll tend to gain back some of the weight. And I noticed, though, and again, Captain Obvious here, that those drugs work way better in people that start an exercise program and actually take this opportunity of not having their appetite and food obsessions be out of control to make changes in their diet, permanent changes. You know, I would say that it's possible that if people take this opportunity when they're starting to have this weight loss, and some people lost like literally 25% of their body weight on these kind of drugs. If you take that opportunity to, you know, double down and really get into an exercise habit and not just, and be more careful about what you eat, then you could probably safely go off the drug and not gain the weight back.
So
that's a big if.
Yeah. Is well, I'm thinking then, because originally I thought it was, Ozempic was just used if you were, let's say, diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Like, you're only able to take it then. But from what it sounds like, you can take it even at an earlier time if you do catch it and realize that you are pre-diabetic then.
Yeah, so, I mean, many of us use it off-label for people that are pre-diabetics, and there's now indication, so not Ozempic, but it's Wegovy and one of those other ones. I mean, there's a lot of similar, I mean, there's a number of drugs that are the brand names for semaglutide and tirzepatide. It's the Mounjaro. But there's a couple of them that have indications now for weight loss.
Yeah,
but that was the secondary finding. You know, they were developed as diabetes meds, and but with the side effect that people were losing a heck of a lot of weight. And so the ATM machine went off in the mind of Big Pharma, and they went, hey.
Well, it sounds like it's been quite the miracle drug for some people.
I think it's overall a success story. Time will tell.
Yeah.
You know, and the ultimate thing, you know, and I think they are seeing some indications of this. Yeah, I mentioned brain health. I think they're seeing that people are doing better from a brain health standpoint and also from a cancer standpoint. You know, I think you're going to see that.
Yes, you're not getting that hyperlipidemia or whatever you were saying.
Because, you know, your insulin resistance is getting addressed. And so you're not going to have that oxidative stress and inflammation associated with this deranged metabolic pathway.
How come we don't hear metabolic syndrome? I mean, it sounds like such a important thing and key thing, but it, you know, when we talk about health, you hear about, you know, the heart, you hear about the brain, you hear about cancer. You don't really, do you agree, Taylor? Do you hear people talking about metabolic syndrome very much?
No,
not that we brought it up.
No, yeah, actually not at all. I mean, my algorithm is mostly just bodybuilders that tell me to eat 2 grams of protein per pound of weight that I have. And that's really it.
Well, I think it gets to our healthcare system, to borrow the well-worn expression, it's really a sick care system. You know,
So they wait for you to have the cancer. They wait for you to have the heart disease. They wait for you to have the.
Yeah, there's just still, and it is just insane. You know, so, a lot of my patients have to pay out of pocket for these medications. Now, as of a couple of days ago, there's a compounding pharmacy, in California where you can order this generic injectable version, but you know, it's amazing how reluctant insurance companies are still to pay for it. Now, in fairness, that may be because of just the exorbitant costs. And if you put the 1/3 of the United States population on this drug, you would clearly bankrupt the system immediately. But the gist of it is if you're diabetic, they'll pay for it. If you're trying not to become diabetic, oh no. They're not going to pay for that.
Which I guess brings me to another question then. So like, has anybody, well, I would have to do more research into this too, because I'm curious about just the cost benefit analysis of being able to prevent being diabetic and then actually just how much it costs for, let's even insurance companies and even out of pocket for some of these folks.
Or self-insurers. Or
self-insurers, yeah.
Here's this really, and this applies to self-insurers and any insurers. So one of the quirks is whoever outlays, it's $1,000 a month. So whoever outlays the $12,000 for this drug and they prevent something 5 or 10 years down the road, the problem is if you're a self-insured employer, your employee in this day and age probably isn't going to be working for you 5 or 10 years down the road. So you're not going to be the one that realizes the benefit. And there's a certain degree of that also with your Blue Cross, Blue Shield, commercial insurance type people. So, that is just another bug in the system of the way our healthcare delivery is set up. It's set up to be sick care. No one wants to pay for anything unless the thing is broken on their watch. And they're not going to necessarily invest in preventing illness 10 or 20 years from now, because they're not going to be the people that realize that benefit. The people, in other words, the entity financially responsible for the person 10 or 20 years from now.
Well, that's why, to me, it seems like it would make sense, because usually at the end of the day, I'm sure I could be wrong, that the burden of the let's say whatever manifests later ends up on the government. The government is responsible at that point to pay for the diabetes or the heart attack or whatever. So you would think that they would want to pay up front to lower the cost of that drug somehow, to subsidize it or something. First of all, it'd be nice if the pharmaceutical company didn't charge so much, but let's say they have to. I think, wouldn't it be worth the government to, you know, pay now to have people have access to it to lower the cost, chip in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's talk around that. I don't know how.
Then if there's some kind
of, how do you ever put that program in place, et cetera? Right.
The whole podcast episode. Other 2-hour conversation, 3-hour, they can go on and on.
Single payer, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions, but it does, my hope is, because it's so exciting to hear all of what Free System Medicine offers, my hope is one day everybody will have access to this, and not just people who can afford to pay out of their pocket in general. I mean, I just, and to have the knowledge is available to us, just as you said, to read books, or I like to listen to Audible. And I like to learn about these things myself and empower myself, because I don't like to rely on, the doctors to tell me.
But as far as, just real quick, somebody say, so Medicaid, which is the
Medi-Cal.
Yeah, from Medi-Cal here in California, but the, subsidized insurance program for economically disadvantaged people. Oddly enough, for preventive stuff and being proactive, those guys could be better than the commercial payers. So
you're saying they are better, or
so I'm saying there is. Yeah, I'm not really certain exactly where they are on
wellness and
on all those things. But speaking to your point that they are going to. Most people on Medicaid don't go on and off it. I think they would tend to be on it for like a long time. So that is going to, so that would be an entity or an avenue where the government, so to speak, is able to step in and democratize it and help people be more proactive and preventive type of mindset over. That's ideally how well they approach that ideal. I'm not so sure, but in theory anyway.
A lot of moving parts in the industry, in the healthcare industry. So to summarize this up then, and then leaving our audience and listeners with just actionable steps moving forward, insulin resistance then affects everything.
So let's just take it down to, start with insulin resistance. Let's just take this metabolic syndrome a piece at a time. So, if your triglycerides run high, you want to take omega-3 fish oils, and you want to avoid those foods. Look it up online: ice cream, ribeye steaks that make your triglycerides go up. We'll handle insulin resistance on our own. For with a lipid profile, that's mostly genetic. So if you have a pretty adverse lipid profile, then you're going to want to consider medications to address that because of the effect that, so I didn't even talk about the, you know, having that bad lipid profile also aggravates atherosclerosis, which we've talked about on other podcasts, which is the, you know, the clogging of your arteries with cholesterol as you work. That's not good for your brain. And again, the, you know, inflammation associated with all that's bad for cancer. So you might consider some kind of medication to adjust that to reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease and neurodegenerative disease. You know, weight loss, we talked about. Insulin resistance, though. So basically, the sad news is here's the best thing you can do is not eat foods high in sugar. Sugar is fructose and sucrose, and fructose is a real culprit here. Avoid processed foods because they're going to tend to have high levels. They're going to have high levels of this fructose, what they call it, fructose corn syrup stuff. You know, things that the food industry puts into foods to make it taste really good, but unfortunately, it's very bad for you. So for insulin resistance, you know, take a look at those food labels. If it says it has added sugar in it, just put it back down. That's what I tell my patients, and that's what I try to adhere to myself. There's certain foods that have sugar in it, like fruits and even vegetables, carrots, you know, celery has a little bit of sugar in it. When it's combined with fiber like that, that's not the thing that's causing the problem. So it's processed foods, foods with added sugar. And when I say processed foods, some of the worst culprits, and you'll learn all this if you put a continuous glucose monitor on yourself, things like bread that's not whole grain, rice.
What else? Tortillas.
Oh, pasta.
Potatoes aren't as bad, right? Or some
people depend. So for me, for whatever reason, potatoes don't move my glucose at all.
And everybody's different.
But everybody's different. I have some patients that say, Dr. Stanford, you said that potatoes would be fine or not. So, it obviously there's some vary from person to person. But suffice to say that carbohydrates, when combined with healthy fats and fiber, are not going to cause the problem that other things like we talked about, pasta, rice, and bread, especially stuff that's not whole grain. And there's a lot of people that try to eat, you know, grain free, you know, is not the worst way to go either.
And be active so that you can keep this homeostasis kind of
right. And then there's other more subtle things like getting your 8 hours of sleep and keeping your stress levels down because of the cortisol has a tremendous effect on blood sugar and insulin metabolism. So you got to keep your stress down.
What about caffeine?
You know, then I got to take my caffeine away.
I know.
I don't know any doctor that, that says you can't get away with one or two cups of coffee before noon. I don't think there's very few that I know of. You know, of course, someone's going to send us an email and go, Dr. Stanford, you are so wrong. But I think one or two cups of coffee before noon is fine.
Got it.
Yeah, that looks great. I learned a lot.
Thanks for joining us on the Precision Medicine Made Simple podcast. If this episode inspired you to learn more about your health, please leave us a review and share the podcast with a friend. Your feedback helps spread the word about the power of precision medicine. Remember, taking action today can lead to a healthier tomorrow. See you next time.